it's a weekend during Missouri's open season, you can probably find James Worley out hunting. Today, he's wading in some brush with his dog near the Osage River. He's looking for duck.
So many people have negative connotations about what wild game's supposed to taste like. It's gamey. It doesn't have to be that way if you cook it properly.
That's how he got the idea of starting Field to Fork. It's an event where he brings in the waterfowl from his hunts, then has local chefs demonstrate how to prepare it so you don't get those gamey qualities that have given waterfowl kind of a questionable reputation. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, it's all about eating local. Not just in the summertime when produce is bountiful, but all winter long. Hunting may be part of the answer. Let's hear a little bit more from the most recent Field to Fork event.
A lot of people aren't used to it because it's just not something you get your hands on unless you're from a community that goes and hunts. I personally never have been, so it's been interesting to get into it and try it out.
It's kind of critical that we understand what the land is giving to us, and not only that, it's just kind of staying true to the roots of where we're at. There's so much available, so much overlooked, and what we're trying to do is to strive for the most absolute local regional cuisine that we possibly can.
Can you imagine ground beef that just sort of crumbles? Now that we've introduced the salt.
It's been very nice to watch people be comfortable with their food. And you know, it's one thing to be comfortable with a carrot, but comfortable with meat is another thing for a lot of people.
The food was amazing. Who knew? You know, it never tasted like that when I was young.
This was all very flavorful and tender and juicy without being livery. So this was a game changer tonight for as far as waterfowl goes and my taste buds.
I think it's important to recognize too that what he's doing with the Field to Fork is helping redefine what Midwestern cuisine is, and getting some of these great chefs to come in and prepare this wild game. I think it's continuing a new understanding of what Midwestern food is, you know, and it's teaching people, you know, here's an animal you can go hunt today, you can bring it in, here's how to clean it, here's how to cook it, and here's how to live the right way.
We just heard from chefs Alex Pope, Rick Mullins, and Mickey Priolo of the Local Pig and Soil Collective, and Field to Fork participants Brian Thompson and Jan Leah. So hunting is one activity that can make eating local and reducing your carbon footprint possible all year long, even when there's a wintry mix to contend with. Later in the show, we'll explore some of the other things people are doing, plus the history of eating local in the winter, before there was any other option. But first, today's show is inspired by Harvest Public Media's new series exploring the relationship between energy and the food industry. It's called Feasting on Fuel. So let's take a step back and understand that relationship a little bit better. Stephanie Joyce is with us from Inside Energy, a hub for environmental journalism. Hi, Stephanie.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. We just heard someone saying that hunting for your own meat could be part of what it means to, quote, live the right way. From an environmental standpoint, would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, you know, there's definitely been a surge in popularity in local eating in recent years, and not just because of energy use, but because of a desire to support local heritage, to support more local jobs, to have more supply chain traceability and fresher products. When it comes to energy, which is what we focused on in this series that we collaborated with Harvest Public Media on, energy-wise, in cold places, especially places like Missouri or Wyoming, where I'm based, in order to grow food in the winter, it really does require a huge amount of energy input. So if the food is grown in, say, a greenhouse, those greenhouses need to be heated, typically with fossil fuels, when the sun goes down. Or if the food is grown indoors under grow lights, those grow lights consume electricity. So it's a complicated question whether eating local is always more energy efficient. You know, my contribution to this series that we did about food and energy focused on indoor farming. In this region, there's a lot of startups that are doing indoor farming because obviously when it's, you know, 15 below zero here in Wyoming in the winter, there aren't a lot of people growing outdoors. But in this region, most of the electricity, like in Missouri, is coal-fired electricity. And so, you know, the kale and the microgreens that they're growing in these indoor farms are essentially a coal derivative. And so there's definitely a lot more direct fossil energy that's going into the growing process. But, you know, that said, I think...
Go on.
I think a lot of people who are doing this kind of growing would say, you know, growing locally cuts down on transportation energy costs. It cuts down on refrigeration. It can even cut down on food waste, you know, because products are harvested when they're ready to be used instead of sitting around in the supermarket and maybe eventually getting thrown out if they're not purchased. So I guess it's hard to assess whether overall it's more energy efficient to eat locally because there are just all these energy inputs throughout our food supply chain.
You talked about people growing like kale and microgreens indoors. Are there things you can grow outdoors this time of year, or is the ground just too hard and cold for any produce?
Certainly in our part of the country, there's not a lot that can be grown outdoors at this time of year. Kale is probably one of the hardiest vegetables, but even the kale dies. There are a lot of operations that grow in greenhouses, but like I said, those do consume a lot of sort of external energy in order to keep functioning in the wintertime.
Well, let's do a little side-by-side comparison. Let's use the example of tomatoes. If I live in Kansas City and I can't make it through the winter without fresh tomatoes, I might head to the store and buy a tomato grown someplace warmer. Maybe it's grown in Mexico. The local option would probably be a tomato grown in a greenhouse. How can you talk about the way that energy is being used for these two products before they land where I might get my hands on them?
Yeah, so, you know, considering that food uses up to 20% of our overall energy in the U.S., there's actually been not that much study of the energy inputs into our food supply chain, surprisingly. There's one report from the USDA that looked at a period between 1997 and 2002 that's really sort of the primary source material for a lot of this information. But that study looked at the energy that goes into all the various parts of our food supply chain. So agriculture, transportation, processing, retail, home use. And the results are actually pretty surprising. You know, when I did interviews for this series, I asked a lot of people on the street, non-experts, where do you think we use the most energy in the food supply chain between growing the food and eating it? And almost everyone said transportation. You know, we see the trucks pulling into the grocery store, we see them driving along the highways, and that's what we think consumes the most energy. But really, no one actually mentioned the things that turn out to be the biggest energy users, which are food processing, retailers, and us.
What do you mean by us?
So us. let me walk through that process a little bit. So basically, I think the most surprising thing that the USDA study found was that we, the individual consumers, are actually the biggest energy users in the entire food supply chain. So each of us individually driving to the grocery store to buy that tomato, to buy our groceries every week or every couple of days even, because people don't necessarily stock up for a whole week every time they go to the grocery store, and then putting that food into our home fridges, our freezers, our extra freezers in many cases, that consumes a tremendous amount of energy. Throughout the rest of the food supply chain, there's a lot of efficiencies of scale. So, you know, in agriculture, there's a lot of efficiencies of scale. In transportation, you're transporting, you know, these commodities in bulk. But each of us individually driving to the grocery store in our gas-burning cars and then putting it into our individual freezers actually ends up using a lot of energy. So we are, it turns out, the biggest energy consumer in the food supply chain. And then, you know, before we ever get into the process, though, there are other big energy consumers like food processing. In 2014, the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows we only spent 35 minutes on average per day on food preparation and cleanup. 35 minutes.
Per person.
Per person. That's compared to more than an hour in 1965. So we've dramatically reduced the amount of time that we are spending in the kitchen making food. And we've replaced a lot of that human labor at home with these mechanical processes outside of the home. So, you know,
so even when we're not using more energy at home, our habits are causing the industry also to use more energy.
Exactly. I mean, think about the produce section at the grocery store. You know, these days, you can't even find a head of lettuce in a lot of cases. It's all pre-washed salad mixes and, you know, there's sliced fruit. And then, you know, think about the frozen food aisle with its pizza and its burritos and all of those, especially frozen and processed fresh foods, you know, they require refrigeration on the way from the farm to the processor. They require refrigeration from the processor to the grocery store. And that consumes a lot of energy. You know, we talked to one Whole Foods store in Colorado for one of our stories, and they pay $250,000 a year for electricity. Half of that goes to refrigeration. So those retail stores that are, you know, storing all of our food until we go to purchase it are also huge consumers of energy.
So it sounds like a lot of what you're talking about is that when it comes to energy consumption, there's a lot more to think about besides local versus non-local. I mean, just how I'm storing my food is not going to change depending on where my tomato came from.
That's right. And I think, you know, there is beyond the local debate, which has gotten a lot of attention, you know, when it comes to energy intensity, there are a lot of other factors to consider, you know, like I mentioned, especially processed foods, ones that require refrigeration or freezing, are incredibly energy intensive. And, you know, then there's the food groups that you need to think about. You know, there's vegetables and grains versus meat. You know, meat is more energy intensive than almost any other food that we consume. And that, you know, applies across the board. Of course, you know, there's huge variations between even something, you know, like a grain-fed cow and a grass-fed cow. Those consume wildly different amounts of energy. And, you know, in your intro, there was some talk of hunting and local, you know, local foods that aren't reliant on grain at all. And those would certainly be more energy efficient than, you know, a cow that's fed a lot of grain throughout the course of its life.
So yeah, let's bring this back to the question of whether eating local makes a difference. I mean, obviously, I'm hearing from you that it's not going to solve the problem, that a lot of what's going to solve the problem is people's individual habits at home and spending time rather than using energy is kind of what I'm hearing. But that being said, everything that makes a difference seems like it would be at least somewhat significant. Would eating local make enough of a difference that it's worth considering as part of this equation?
You know, I think even more important than local versus non-local are some of these things that I talked about in terms of, you know, processing and storage of food. So, you know, if you're really concerned about the energy footprint of your food, eating more things that don't require refrigeration or freezing, eating more traditional foodstuffs, you know, that are canned or dried or smoked, all of those ways that we preserved food before we had refrigeration are certainly going to be less energy intensive than, you know, the things that have to be refrigerated all the way from the farm to, you know, the processing plant and then are processed with mechanical machinery and then end up in our fridges or freezers at home, which use a lot of energy.
It does seem funny. I mean, when we talk about the struggles of eating local when it's freezing cold in the winter, and that in the same conversation we're talking about the energy perils of all of the refrigeration we're doing. I mean, are there old school refrigeration techniques that we should be considering?
You know, there's certainly people out there trying to work on more efficient refrigeration systems. I don't know that they're actually very old school. I think a lot of them are very new school. And
so no one's
new
saying
technology.
Like set it on the porch?
Not that I've heard, but you know, this Whole Foods store that I mentioned in Colorado that we talked to, they're using some really innovative freezing technologies. You know, one of the people that we interviewed said, you know, really no one has looked at refrigeration. It's been around for about 160 years now, and there hasn't been a lot of innovation in that particular area. So now is probably a good time to start looking at how we could perhaps be more energy efficient in our refrigeration or freezing. And, you know, of course, if you feel like putting stuff out on the porch and it's cold enough to keep your food, you know, safe, I think certainly that's an option. I don't know how many people are going to turn off their refrigerators or their freezers and leave it to chance, especially, you know, with the wild temperature fluctuations that I know are possible in the Midwest. But that's obviously an option.
When you, I mean, I'm interested in the fact that it sounds like you're really looking forward for solutions. A lot of what I feel like we're talking about also sounds to me like looking back. I mean, using less industrialized techniques, whether you're talking about getting fruits and vegetables or some kind of meat, like Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House on the Prairie type stuff, churning your own butter, hunting elk, or like canning your tomatoes in the summer to get you through the winter. Is that part of the solution, or do you really think that it's industry and technology that we should be turning to help solve the problems that arguably industry and technology have created?
I think there are going to be people who argue that issue on both sides. And obviously, you know, looking forward, there's just a lot of people who are very busy. They want convenience. They're not going to go out and, you know, hunt their own game. They're not going to can their own tomatoes in the summer. And there are certainly, you know, improvements that can be made on an industrial scale that will allow for the convenience that we're comfortable with, while also, you know, looking backwards, I think canning and hunting and all of those things are going to be a future solution.
Stephanie Joyce of Inside Energy, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
When we return, our next guest knows how people managed to eat local through winters before supermarkets offered clementines from Florida and Hawaiian mahi-mahi, plus a local grocer shares his insights. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for more Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and our goal on today's show is to figure out whether it's possible in this day and age to eat local through Midwestern winters, and if so, how? Eating local has been touted as a great way to improve the health of the planet. We've just heard that it's somewhat more complicated than that, but depending on the specific approach, it could make a difference. So we thought we'd look to history for examples of surviving brutal winters without access to the international bounty of supermarket aisles. Food historian Andrea Broomfield is here. She's just written a book called Kansas City, a Food Biography. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
How far back does your research into this area's food history take us?
It takes us back about 12,000 years ago, actually, to when the very first prehistoric peoples were living in caves that they were digging out along the banks of tributaries and along the Missouri and Kaw rivers.
So the series of books you're contributing to includes food biographies of lots of American cities. When you compare Kansas City's early food history, I mean, like 12,000 years ago, history, with other areas with similar climates, is there a lot of overlap, or did people around here have their own really particular ways of using what was available to them?
Well, that's a really good question. And the research into Kansas City prehistoric peoples is ongoing. And I hate to say it, but there's still not a lot for me to be able to tell you where there would have been significant overlap with the same kind of foods and foodways as the peoples who lived elsewhere. But what we think was happening would be that there were exchanges of ideas and trade routes that went all the way back to places like Taos in New Mexico, today's New Mexico, and then along the rivers, travel would occur, particularly along the Missouri and the Mississippi from the settlements that were so famous, like Cahokia, for example. So clearly there would have been some exchanges of foods and ideas that would have happened with these prehistoric peoples. And
so they, I mean, maybe weren't entirely eating local?
Probably not entirely, because there were so many things that became coveted so quickly. I mean, take something as precious as salt. And if you're going to preserve food, salt is one of the most important ways that you're going to do it. And so I think a lot of these ancient trade routes would have had people bringing to this area things like salt, and in trading, maybe not food per se, but maybe some sort of stone or some sort of metal item in exchange for that salt, or in exchange for that corn, or whatever else might have been important.
By and large, like later on, when there was sort of what we call the settlement of the United States, which mm-hmm. of course there were people living all over the United States before that quote unquote settlement. But by and large, where did settlers around here come from, and did they bring things with them that helped them survive and influenced mm-hmm. food traditions, particularly in the winter?
Absolutely. The earliest European settlement in this area would have been the French. And a lot of the French were coming from New Orleans as well as from St. Louis and the Choteaus, who were the first successful traders in this area, were coming from St. Louis, where they had extended family ties. And even though it was very difficult to transport food in the winter, you could at least transport it in the spring and the summer. And so
it would just be here?
Part of the cargo on those keel boats that took so much effort to bring into this area along the rivers would have had precious supplies like olive oil and cane sugar and wheat flour that were indeed precious. But if you had some money, you could afford some of those luxuries. But that would have been Francois and Bernice Choteau and not so many of the other settlers who were congregating around this area.
So olive oil and sugar and things like that, right. They're things we really take for granted today.
Right.
Not sort of the... When I think about what I'd have a hard time going without in the wintertime, if I was really trying to eat totally locally, of course I use olive oil that comes from somewhere else, but that is not even part of what I'm thinking about.
Right.
I'm thinking about things like orange juice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, were there major like nutritional gaps that people were experiencing, to your knowledge, when their non-local foods in the wintertime were things like olive oil and sugar, and it kind of
right.
ended there?
Well, I think that what we struggle with today to understand is that people 200 years ago had such a wealth of knowledge about what they needed to eat and how to procure it that we just don't think about today. So I would say that people ate pretty good, all things considered. I mean, you could get lots of vitamin C from rose hips, and roses grew wild, and people knew how to gather the hips and how to create teas and all kinds of extracts that would have made sure that they had vitamin C, even if they might not have necessarily known that they needed a daily dose of vitamin C. You had all kinds of wild flora and fauna that were supplying the needs, and people just knew what to eat and how to eat it. And the earliest settlers would have learned that from the Native Americans, and they would have copied many of their preservation techniques to ensure that they got enough protein and got enough vitamin, whatever, K,
yeah.
E, and were able to understand how to, I guess the best word is to exploit the native environment around them so that they had enough to eat and they were able to put the food away for the winter.
What about the Native Americans who were here before them? I mean, what were some of the traditions that they had developed that either were or were not copied by settlers later on?
I kind of liked what Stephanie said earlier about energy and conservation, and I think that the most important thing that Native Americans were using when Europeans arrived was conservation of energy through dried foods in particular. So lots and lots of foods that we today think of as canned or that we eat fresh would have been dried, and they would be dehydrated and then rehydrated in the winter. And so a great example would be pumpkins, which are squashes in general, which just grew prolifically in this area. And Native women would take those pumpkins and they would they would take them out of the skin, and they would partially dry them, and then they would pound them into literal mats, and then they would entirely dry them, and they could stack that pumpkin dried as it was, and then reconstitute it in stews. And they would take the black cherries off the native black cherry tree. They would crush those down, and they would extract the pits, and then they would dry them as patties that could then be put in a stew of, say, venison or turkey. So it flavored, and it also added nutrition to what would have been a largely game-based diet, particularly in the winter.
Are there things that we've always had really plentiful access to around Kansas City in the wintertime? I mean, from things that we would now call produce to animal-based foods. I mean, you've already mentioned a few examples. What else is here that maybe we don't even think about?
Well, if you just take a walk along Indian Creek Trail as an example, every season of the year, with the exception of the dead of winter, you're going to find things growing that you could eat. It might be hickory nuts in the fall. It might be gooseberries in the summer. It might be wild garlic or ramps in the early spring. And it's just a matter of understanding what you're looking at and becoming better equipped to go out and forage for it. But I hesitate to encourage people to just rush out and start foraging, because you've got such a wildlife population also depending on a lot of those foods that are particularly tasty, say hazelnuts, for example.
We heard earlier that our modern preservation techniques, largely refrigeration, mm-hmm. Might not be great for the environment, even on the individual scale, not to mention the industrial scale. What were some of the early techniques for preserving foods from one season to another, or even just from one day to the next, if something was prepared and you wanted to make the most of any leftovers that might exist, for example?
Well, again, drying was critical. So many, many kinds of foods, from bison meat that became jerky to pumpkins that were dehydrated, were typically just conserving the energy from the sun to then be reconstituted in the winter. Something that made life a little more pleasurable for the French was that they loved to take wild plums, all kinds of wild berries, strawberries, for example, and then the native black cherry, and they would produce cordials and wines with it, so that the winter was a little less dull. So we don't think about the fact that so much of our native berries were exploited by the French to make
fermentation.
Yes, or to make as much of a kind of wine as they could possibly make with ingredients that were not from France.
How eventually did greater access to non-local foods change our city and our region, even our culture?
Well, there's a lot I could say about that, but sometimes I think that the history of Kansas City food is sort of an embarrassment about the kinds of foods that we like and take for granted. And so with the advent of industrialization, you get a lot of restaurants, for example, who don't want to showcase native foods, because that would be sort of calling attention to the fact that we're a whole bunch of, quote, hayseeds. And so restaurants try to mimic the kind of cuisine that you could get in New York or Boston or Chicago. In other words, food almost becomes homogenous, and our understanding of what's sophisticated and good is somewhat based on what other people elsewhere are eating.
That's so interesting, because right now I feel like there's this huge trend toward the sort of locally grown,
yes,
locally sourced. But I hear what you're saying. I mean, even so, the menu items, the overall menus if anything, seem more and more alike. The popularity of kale everywhere you
right.
go can't be a coincidence.
Well, I think that what's happened in Kansas City and elsewhere is that people are actually rediscovering and celebrating regional foods and regional tastes. But industrialization makes it awfully easy and economical to go ahead and eat what everyone else is eating.
Does eating local matter to you? If so, we want to hear your questions, ideas, and experiences eating local in Kansas City, especially in the wintertime. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. More in just a minute on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been chatting with food historian Andrea Broomfield about what people ate to survive the winter in and around Kansas City back in the day before there was a really significant choice besides eating local. You can join our conversation about eating local in the wintertime at 816-235-2888. Our next guest will talk to us about people who are trying to bring it back in style. Aaron Prater runs The Sundry, a Crossroads grocery store that carries foods from local producers. Hi, Aaron.
Hello, morning.
What inspired you to open The Sundry?
A lot of things, but one of them was mostly accessibility of local food. I was fortunate enough to grow up hunting and fishing and eating local, and I miss those things. And you know, to be able to have it year round consistently was something that was lacking, I thought. And so that was one of the main motivations.
How does it work? I mean, between you and the producers who supply your store with all the foods you sell, I mean, what kinds of things do local producers put on your shelves and how do you do business with them? I mean, is it visiting farms? I mean, tell me a little bit more about how it works for you on the backside of it.
Sure. We spent a year reaching out to farmers and producers, asking questions, visiting farms, things like that. For this first year of operation, we basically told anybody in Kansas City that was making or growing something, bring it in. We're curious and bring us whatever you have because we want everything. And that's essentially how it's worked is a farmer will bring us, you know, his kale, but then also say, hey, I've got a bunch of these watermelon radishes. Are you interested in this? And so a lot of the producers have brought things to us that we didn't know were available. And we buy direct from them and then sell. And we use them in the kitchen too. So we'll take some of that food and offer it for sale. But we also have a kitchen that turns that into lunch or dinner or a take-home meal.
How does your approach to business toward that supply chain differ from the standard grocery store approach to ordering and supplying? They usually go more through distributors, right?
Sure. We do have a distributor that we use for some staple things that we can't get locally. But mostly we're dealing one-on-one with farmers, producers. They come in every week and the guy who brings us our hogs every Thursday shows up every Thursday with a hog over his shoulder.
Wow. I mean, is it feasible, do you think, in this day and age for a grocer who isn't fulfilling a passion, is not trying to reconnect with some really positive personal experience, who's just trying to make a living? Do you think that on a large scale we would see people going to the model you're using, or is that challenging? I mean, to go to individual local producers on a one-on-one basis as opposed to distributors who bring all kinds of things to a store and act kind of as middlemen.
Sure. It'd be very challenging. It's been very challenging. I would like to say that, you know, we're moving that way and there's more farmers, more producers, so it would be easier. And there's, you know, talk of a lot of ways to make that process easier for somebody that wants to get into this. But right now it's still, we're writing the blueprint as we go.
Yeah. I mean, could you talk about what some of the challenges have been? Because one of the stories from the Harvest Public Media series, Feasting on Fuel, explores the disconnect between the schedules of farming and the schedules of eating, of shopping, of restaurants, of kind of, you know, the urban populations where they sell their food. It seems like distributors have in some ways sort of facilitated that connection and that you would have some challenges in to overcome.
Sure. You know, that's a multifaceted problem that we're struggling with constantly. People are so used to eating strawberries in December, but I don't have strawberries in December. I have sweet potatoes and most people don't know what to do with sweet potatoes anymore, other than Thanksgiving, which is past, so nobody wants them anymore. So one of the reasons we paired a kitchen with the market was to show, here's what you can do with these ingredients. Here's how you can take sweet potatoes and make them savory, turn them into a curry, or turn them into a savory pie that maybe you didn't think about because you've only ever had it with marshmallows on top.
So sweet potato, is that something that people are producing like right now?
They've come out of the ground already, but they're curing them. And so one of the older preservation methods, and if you drive around the countryside around here, you see them everywhere, was to have root cellars. And they're these in-ground brick holes where they would store their cabbages and their potatoes and their sweet potatoes. And so a lot of farmers are bringing those potatoes out of those cellars and selling them to us. And so potatoes, beets, sweet potatoes, we're still getting some radishes and some turnips, some things like that. Those are available to us most of the winter.
What, you touched on this with strawberries, but are there even more like staple type items that you just can't get if you're trying to eat local here in Kansas City in the wintertime?
Citrus is a great example. You just can't. Citrus is never going to grow here. And we know that our customers want it, and we like having it for cooking. So we bring in some citrus that isn't local. And trying to live on a completely local diet, there just aren't the producers anymore. There isn't availability to that stuff. And so we have to supplement local and sort of conventionally produced stuff. But citrus is probably one of the biggest ones that we run into problems with.
What do you think is one of the more surprising products that exists in your store that people are surprised to see that this is coming from somewhere around Kansas City?
I think our sodas. We make our own sodas in-house, and one of the really cool ones is we have some wild forage persimmons that we turned into a paste to preserve them, and then we started playing with it, and we turned it into a carbonated drink that uses wild local Missouri persimmons.
We have a note from Dale, who is a full-time organic farmer in Lawrence. She called in earlier in the show, couldn't stay on the line, but wanted to share that there are things that you can grow locally all winter long. She has spinach and kale growing under row covers right now that are still producing. Row covers, I'm sadly not familiar. Is this something you're familiar with, working with farmers throughout
the year? I'm a little familiar with it. It's basically just a small little cover that you put over the rows to keep them growing and keep the frost off and things like that. And they will extend the season. And we are getting local kale brought in from farmers still today.
When someone makes a food product here in Kansas City, and particularly something that might be a prepackaged kind of item, not just the fresh produce out of the ground, how often would you say that they're also having to use non-local materials to make whatever it is that is the final product, the local product that a local person made nonetheless?
You know, that's tough to say. I would say the vast majority of it is conventionally produced product, just because the cost and the availability. Farmers grow a lot of tomatoes, but they go to the farmers markets with them first, and then the guy that gets the seconds maybe doesn't have enough to do a full run, and the consistency and quality, it's really hard. The local food community is growing quickly, but sometimes they don't meet the demand for a producer.
Canning has become pretty popular. Do you work with local canners?
Absolutely. We work with several local canners. We get canned beets and canned tomatoes and canned pickles and lots of canned jams and jellies and things like that.
Tell me the story there. I mean, what is your sense of the local canning community? It's become so popular again. How has that played out here in town?
We have one company that we started with a year ago, and they're just their success is we've been watching it rise every month after month, because people are responding really well, and it's a lot of fun. The nice thing about it is that is local food that you can have year round. It doesn't matter what the temperature is, and we've tried to work with our customers and explain, oh, this jam's great if you want to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but it's also great if you want to put it on cheese, or if you want to mix it into a sauce or a salad dressing, and just showcase the the ways that you can use a canned product. You know, canned tomatoes, you don't just open them up and eat them, you turn them into something. And these are all the wonderful things that you can make with it. And so there's a lot of education that goes into that. And I think canning's one of those things people aren't afraid to buy a jar of something that they understand, whereas if they get a kohlrabi, maybe they don't know what to do with it.
Are there, I mean, aside from canning, are there other historic food preservation techniques that are making a comeback that people are giving a try, like drying or?
Sure. You don't see as much drying. I think a lot of people have home dehydrators sometimes, but that's not as popular. One of the ones that we've seen a lot of success with is curing and smoking, the charcuterie methods, bacon. We teach a bacon class, and the popularity of that's been phenomenal. We bring people in and we teach them, hey, here's a piece of pork belly and here's how you make bacon.
Yeah, bacon's really popular.
Yeah.
So bacon, you would consider an approach to preserving
Absolutely.
Pork.
Salting is considered one of the earliest methods of preservation.
Andrea, is there a lesson from the past that you think we'd do well to remember in the context of this conversation?
Well, it does take a lot of time for some people to be able to can their food and brine their food and dry it. But I do think that there are so many ways that we can be working in some of these traditional arts that don't actually have to take that much time. And, you know, just buying an air dehydrator and hanging it on your porch and filling it with herbs from your garden so that in the wintertime you've got as much sage and thyme as you want. Or just having stone crocks that you can purchase new and filling them with vegetables from the garden and brining them in vinegar doesn't take that much time and is probably really good for your gut's health. So there are all kinds of ways I think that people should be working into their kitchens ways to utilize dried food, pickled food, smoked food that will give them more of a sense of autonomy, I guess, and ownership of what they're eating, as opposed to having to be dependent on somebody else to do it for them.
Erin, as someone who has, I mean, do you have much direct interaction with your customers?
Oh, yeah, every day.
Would you say that things like autonomy and independence and agency when it comes to food, that those things factor into why people want to shop at a place like the Sundry?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's two sides to that. There's the ability to make your own decisions and do the things that you want to do and have that those sort of raw ingredients. But we also have a lot of people that just want to eat local, but they still want the convenience of modern day. And so our mission is kind of to make local food accessible, whether you're that home hobbyist who wants to make your own sauerkraut, or you're somebody that just wants to eat local and support local, but not do as much work.
We've been getting some input from more people who are talking about things like greens, like spinach and kale, how we can grow them in the Midwest in the winter. And Dave called to say that you can build a cold frame even on a small city lot and grow leafy greens all year long. Talk to me, is that a technique that you're seeing people use?
Yeah, I see that in a lot of the small urban farm, like home backyard farms. Most of the people that we're dealing with are commercial farms, local commercial farms, and they're on a much bigger scale than that. And so putting together a long hoop house or a half-dug hoop house that's got some earth contact to kind of regulate temperatures more, it takes a lot more work and a lot more investment. And people aren't going to the farmers markets in January, so the farmers don't necessarily have that income to support an investment like that all the time. But a lot of them are trying it to move the local food cause further.
Are there other techniques that farmers are trying to make the winter a more productive time?
Yeah, farmers are really ingenious people, and they're looking at a bunch of different ways. In fact, of the Earth Farm and Distillery, where we get our hogs from, he has a still where he uses local apples and makes apple brandy, and then he feeds the hogs the leftover mash from the still. But then he's also looking at ways to recycle the heat and water waste from that still into fish ponds or local shrimp ponds or things like that. So farmers, if they can figure out a way to make the land more useful, they will.
What do you think about the consumer side of this equation? I mean, so much of what we heard earlier in the conversation is that when you're thinking about energy, it's really our own habits that are causing the most havoc. And, you know, the rest of the industrial side of it is obviously responding on some level to also our demand. So what do you think the impact that consumers can have on grocers, even grocers who aren't following your model?
Sure. You know, I think it's tremendous. But more than anything, it takes education and a different attitude from the consumers and from the retailers to say we can't do things the way we've always done things. You know, as making a more sustainable, a local food thing is going to take thinking outside the box. And it takes some sacrifice on the consumer end and some sacrifice on the retail end. And that's been the hardest challenge for us, is the education of what does that take to get the consumers there. But they've really responded. We've got the best customers in Kansas City. They come every day and they love it.
Do you have a sense of what's motivating your customers, maybe even aside from the issues we've talked about?
I think people want honesty in food. I think they want simplicity. Local food doesn't need to be fancy. You know, it doesn't need to be the food of New York or the food of Paris. It can be Kansas City food.
How would that be different?
Local food has sort of become really popular in the fine dining world. But fine dining isn't where you're going to see the most change, because that's a luxury to most people. We try to make food accessible and available every day. And so it's not food that is, you know, has five different sauces and plated with tweezers and custom made flatware. You know, we make meatloaf, but it's really good local meatloaf. You know?
So I guess I'm kind of hearing, like, sometimes when people think about eating local, what they're trying to do is eat what they can get non-locally, but just a local version, instead
right.
of changing their eating habits based on what actually is local.
Right. Yeah. Everybody eats maple syrup on their pancakes, but maple syrup doesn't grow here. You know, there are options out there. And in fact,
like what?
Box elder syrup, as right. mentioned in Andrea's book.
Talk to me about that, Andrea.
Well, the box elder is a subspecies, I think is the word, of maple. And when the earliest settlers came here, they observed that Native Americans were boiling the sap from the box elder to make their own version of maple syrup. And so they would learn that, and they would use that syrup to make a kind of lemonade using the wild sumac berries, which are extremely tart. So they would mash down those berries and brew them and then mix them with the box elder syrup and water and make their own version of lemonade.
When you research historic foods like this, mm-hmm. is it possible for you to somehow taste what it is you're studying, or is it just inaccessible now? I mean, have you tried this stuff?
Well, Aaron and I have talked about going out and trying to harvest some box elder sap so we can see exactly how it would work. I mean, so I haven't done it with that, but we have plans.
Yeah, we've a couple of our farmers have identified some stands of box elders, and we've got plans over the course of the next year to forage and hunt and find and preserve, pickle, cure, cook all of the local foods of Kansas City.
And just so you know, we're getting some input from people who are noting that there are some farmers markets that still go on, apparently one in Lawrence. And
sure. Yeah. And farmers markets are fantastic. And it's a great way to get involved and eat that local food. It's because of local farmers markets and local farmers that we've seen the rise of local food that we have. But it's really inconvenient on a Tuesday night if none of them are open to eat local sometimes. Part of the problem with local food is the availability and accessibility of it and getting to it. Unless you know on Saturday morning or Tuesday afternoon or whatever time that farmer's market's open what you want to eat for the week, you kind of have some problems.
And in the winter with farmers markets, what you were talking about, was it more that people aren't doing as much shopping there and therefore farmers can't rely on it as much?
Yeah, exactly, because not everybody wants 50 pounds of sweet potatoes.
Right. Well, our time is up for today's show. Aaron Prater of The Sundry, good luck to you, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Andrea Broomfield, we'll have to have you back to talk more about your book, Kansas City, A Food Biography. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This morning's conversation was inspired by a series from Harvest Public Media called Feasting on Fuel. You can catch all the great reporting in the series at harvestpublicmedia.org. Be sure and check it out. And share this conversation with your friends via kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you later today. Tomorrow, drone policy, hits close to home for some Kansas Cityans, and I mean that literally. Tune in for that discussion tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with help today from Suzanne Hogan. Special thanks to Julie Denishay for the hunting story earlier in the hour. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date next on KCUR.